need to go to aaronsgunshop.com. And when there, go to the license to carry page, and there you'll find the upcoming classes that we offer. And I believe the next one's on the 30th. Sign yourself up to take a class with me so you can be on your road to getting your license. But why wait till it's too late to get your license? Defend yourself now. The course time is approximately 5 hours, and then five and a half hours, and that includes your written and shooting tests. And the fee for the course is $60. So trust me, you won't be bored. Trust me, you won't be bored. I've been teaching for a long time to many, many people, and I've got lots of tricks up my sleeve to help you better learn and you know, in a shorter time, learn what you have to learn. Like a 10-hour class, I can teach you in a 5-hour class. And that's just because I know what I'm doing, I know how to teach it, I can get it into your head, and you'll retain it. So go to aaronsgunshop.com, go to the license to carry page, sign up now for class. They fill up quickly, so don't wait too long. Go to aaronsgunshop.com, the license to carry page. Now, ladies and gentlemen, on our pet section today, preparedness eliminates panic. We're going to talk to you about how to sharpen a knife with a whetstone. That's W-H-E-T-S-T-O-N. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I use a knife all the time. And from cleaning my nails, that's the main purpose of knife, opening letters, cutting open boxes, cutting rope, tape, wood, food, using the knife blade as a screwdriver, and any other task that can make my knife do because I lack the proper tools at the time makes not having a knife extremely difficult to get anything done. So with my knife being used for so many things, the blade's edge can become damaged or worn or dull. The worst thing to have is a dull knife. A dull knife can, be just as dangerous as a sharp knife, since you need to exert a lot more pressure on the blade to make it do its job. Because I use my knife so much, I had, keep sharpening it, keeping it up to speed, and all that kind of stuff. Well, this to many can be a daunting task due to the lack of knowledge on how to sharpen a knife. Now, I know how to sharpen a knife, but I'm still not the best at sharpening a knife. I can get the job done and get it done efficiently, but there are some people there who are just masters at sharpening a knife blade. So what I did was I was shopping around on the Internet to find someone who could put into words that we can all understand. And what I've come up with is what I'm about to read to you now. And the following is how to sharpen your knife with a whetstone. It's from lovetheoutdoors.com, okay? So I'm going to read to you what I looked up here. It's pretty cool, pretty decisive, pretty clear as to, hey, what's going on, buddy? Good to see you. And I'm just going to read to you here. It's from the lovetheoutdoors.com. How to sharpen a knife with a whetstone. This is pretty cool. If you got a knife, and I'm telling you, you can walk around, you see the clip standing out of the person's pocket, front pocket. They got a knife, a lock blade or something. This article is basically designed for a fixed blade, but it can work for any blade as well. So let me read to you what it is. If you've ever had to use a knife in the outdoors, you likely already know that a dull blade is just about worthless. From whittling kindling to cutting rope and fishing line, outdoor knives take a lot of abuse and tend to dull quickly. Thus, knowing how to properly sharpen a knife properly pays high dividend to the avid outdoor adventurer or a person who carries a knife in their pocket, cutting boxes and all that kind of stuff. Okay? Whetstone is generally considered to be the easiest to use and the most immediately effective tool for knife sharpening. So let's go to preparation. Before busting out the knife and getting to work, you'll need to prep your whetstone. And ladies and gentlemen, I've been reading a whole bunch of articles, and a lot of people kind of say the same thing here. There's got to be something to it. So I'm not the expert. I'm going to read to you what they say. You might want to listen up to this, and you experts might want to, call in sometime or write an email to me, whatever, at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com. But here we go. Though there is some room for debate on the subject, most people with a lot of knife experience recommend that you soak the whetstone in cold, clean water for about 10 minutes before you begin sharpening. I guess it seals up the pores. It lifts up the fragments of metal. And before you start sharpening, set up your sharpening station, place a towel down on a flat, stable surface, and put the whetstone on top of it. Test it out by applying some directional force to your palm to ensure the stone won't be sliding around as you sharpen it. All right, the sharpening process. Proper knife sharpening is all about angles. So true. If you sharpen the knife unevenly or use too wide of an angle, you're likely to end up with a nicked or dull blade. To sharpen your knife correctly, start with the coarse side of the whetstone facing upward. Touch the knife to the stone at its base on the lengthwise side of the stone that is closest to you at a 20-degree angle. So it's going to be up at an angle like this. And this angle is extremely important. And for a reference point, this is pretty cool. Check this out. If you're watching me on the Ustream, you can see this. 20 degrees is about the angle of a book of matches from the bottom and top. So you got a book of matches, you open it up, you take the match out. Well, when you close it, it kind of looks like a triangle, right? When you lay it on the table, the flat side's on the table, and then it comes up. Well, that angle right there, the top part of the cover, that's about a 20-degree angle. Next, apply moderate downward pressure with your fingers on the backside of the blade and push it forward in a diagonal motion. The tip of the knife should be just touching the stone as you reach the stone's end. Keep the knife on the stone as you bring it back towards so as to maintain the angle. So you're going to go forward the angle and just bring it back gently. Don't apply any pressure on it. Repeat this process for 10 to 20 strokes, then flip the knife over and do it again. When you completed this step, it's time to wipe off the blade, flip the stone over to the fine side, and repeat again. And this will take off any leftover jagged steel on the blade's edge that the coarse side couldn't get. After the requisite 10 to 20 strokes on each side, your blade is sharp and ready to cut wood. And it's true, ladies and gentlemen, when you use a whetstone, I've done this with multiple knives. It may not be perfect. It may not be able to, you know, shave with it, but it's sure enough sharp enough to do the job, okay? All right, let's talk about finishing up here. Before putting your knife sharpening setup away, be sure to wipe off the knife blade and check its edge for any nicks or inconsistencies. There's no need to fret if you see one, as a little more work on the whetstone's fine side will take care of it in a hurry. And as with any skill involving knives, it's important to take your time and be careful the first few times you sharpen. A little extra care will result in a much sharper, safer, and more useful blade. Okay. So that's our pep section for today, talking about knives. That just gives you a hint. I mean, I can't tell you everything, ladies and gentlemen, on the short amount of time that we have on the radio. So what it does is it whets your appetite to see, hey, this is something I'm interested in. Oh, I didn't know that. Hell, man, go Google it. Go Google it. You can find anything you want pretty much on Google. Google knows more than what you know, or knows more of what you're thinking than you know what you're thinking, okay? So just check it out. Look some things up, whatever pertains to your particular lifestyle or type of knife, so on and so forth, and you can figure out what to do and how to do it well, okay? So with that, we're going to take a break. Guys, we're going to take about a minute and a half break, and when we come back, we're going to have a special guest on, Patty Mara. She's the editor of the Common Ground newsletter for Aaron's Gun Shop. She's got a whole new article coming up on the blog site there. If you want to listen to it, it's a pretty good segment, too. And so when we come back after about a minute and a half, we'll be talking with Patty, and we'll see you on the other side.
Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures. If you've decided to carry a handgun for self-defense, you better know what you're doing. If you don't, you better learn fast. Not only fast, but thoroughly. Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures fills the void between a Johnny wannabe and a person who has been properly trained in the proper handling and use of a firearm. Call me, Matt Bitros, at 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com and set up a class or seminar to get you started on the road to proficiency with a firearm for self-defense. Go to our website, aaronsgunshop.com, and review the High Cap Adventures page. We have seminars to cover most forms of firearms training. Call 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com to get more information on how to get started with your training. The time for games is over. Reality starts now. aaronsgunshop.com.
I'm Bill Conway with On the Dock. I'd like to invite everyone out to fish the 16th annual Central Texas Police Chiefs and Sheriffs Association Spring Bass Classic on Stillhouse Hollow Lake, April 16th. Pre-registration is going on now. You can pre-register at Marine Outlet in Temple, Texas, or at Tightline's Premium Fishing Tackle in Killeen. Don't forget, that's April the 16th on Stillhouse Hollow Lake.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio Program. This is Matt with Aaron's Gun Shop. We're live here at ANC Firearms in Heidenhammer. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're in Temple or west of Temple, you need to just take the drive. Arch Koontz and his staff here, not only do they have a cool-looking building, it's the old bank building at the major intersection here in Heidenhammer, but they got a lot of stuff in here. I mean, you can't walk without bumping into stuff. And if they don't have it, they can get it. And Arch, I've known Arch for a long time. He, for some reason, I don't know how he does it, but he has access, or he's able to get guns that are hard to get. And I know I come to him sometimes to get those hard-to-get guns, because for some reason he's got an inside source. But anyway, you need to come on out here. We're going to be here until about 1:30. You get to meet the staff and Arch's staff as well. But right now, let me tell you this. If you're looking for an advanced or specialized training when it comes to using a firearm, you need to go to aaronsgunshop.com and go to the ICAP Adventure page. And on that page is where we have listed our special training seminars. And those seminars include home and self-defense training seminar, ladies-only home and self-defense training seminar, combat shotgun seminar, M4 close quarters combat training seminar, and semi-automatic rifle training seminar. And, of course, we've got a PEP training seminar. So go to Aaron's Gun Shop High Cabin Adventure page and check out all what we have to offer on those particular seminars. These seminars are geared for the homeowner or regular Joe or Jane on the street. These particular seminars are not designated for the combat operator, the spec operator. So we can adjust it for that, but it's not designed for that. We're looking to help people out who have a house in the city, house in the country, ranch, whatever. You know, and you're going to wake up in the middle of the night in your underwear and pick up your gun, your pistol, your rifle, shotgun, whatever, and you basically got to know what you're doing. That's the kind of stuff we do. Okay? So if you wish to sharpen your skills, give us a call. Groups of five or more can arrange for private classes. Just go to aaronsgunshop.com, the High Cap Adventure page. Sign up now, and we'll get you squared away, okay? Or give me a call or send me an email at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very honored and privileged to have here with me a special guest, Patty Marek. And she is my editor for the Common Ground newsletter for Aaron's Gun Shop. Go to aaronsgunshop.com and go to the blog page. You get to see what she writes up there. And today she's got a special article from someone else she'll be explaining in just a second. But we've got her here live with us. I'll tell you what, Patty, we're streaming live on our Facebook page. Patty, I want to get you in here because you're going to be showing some pictures. There she is. If everybody can say hi. Here we go. Go to aaronsgunshop.com. Go to the Facebook page. You get to see us streaming live here. And she'll be talking to you and showing you a couple diagrams. But Patty, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here again. Anything on the top of your head you want to say before we get into this?
No, I think this information is very apropos to what we're doing out at Aaron's Gun Shop.
Apropos, and that's a dollar word. I'm a 50-cent kind of guy.
Oh,
what the hell did you just
it's
say?
It's appropriate. This is appropriate to everybody.
Okay, very good.
Everybody.
Very good.
Yeah.
All right, it's your show. Take it away. Patty, you're going to talk to us about your blog. You've got a great article here you're going to talk about. You'll explain it, and I'll come back to you with some commentary and questions.
Okay, I found this article on a website for Radix Tactical. It's a gun shop training facility in Talladega, Alabama. And I asked permission to read this, and they said, hey, absolutely. And I told them that I would give them thumbs up on it. Its website is www.radixtactical.com.
Still Radix.
R-A-D-I-X.
R-A-D-I-X. Okay.
Radixtactical.com. They're in Talladega. If you feel like taking a road trip, call me. I'll go. Let's go see what's going on.
Okay.
But this article was submitted on their blog by a man named Jason Burke, and he is a police officer and head instructor at Radix Tactical, and I thought this was good information.
To be honest with you, I get this feeling for some reason I must have trained this guy. Go ahead.
Hey, this is good stuff, and I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to show you a few diagrams that he had, and we'll hold them up here in just a minute and let you see them. Here is the text of his article, and the title is, You Should Not Feel Safe If You Own a Gun.
Not feel safe if you own a gun? Huh?
You should not feel safe if you own a gun. All right, here we go. It says, owning a gun can give you a false sense of security that is frankly dangerous. In fact, this false sense of security could cost you your life. Why would a police officer who believes in the Second Amendment and that most law-abiding citizens should be armed, make such a comment? The reason stems from my weekly experience at my local indoor firing range. Given the typical array of guns and gear, the average clientele of the range caters to middle, upper-class, upper-income middle income, that kind of thing, folks. So these are reasonably intelligent people with good equipment. The problem is many of them are dangerous with their firearms, and after watching thousands of rounds fired over the years, I am convinced that most could not use their firearms to save their lives or the lives of their loved ones during a violent attack. Why do I say this? Well, if standing still, you can't hit a stationary paper target kill zone at least 75% of the time, there's little chance you're going to hit something that is moving while under stress. The overwhelming majority of range targets I see are peppered across the entire paper boundary with little if no pattern in essential areas, demonstrating little if any ability to be precise, even while standing stationary in a completely controlled and safe environment. 100% of violent encounters create extremely high stress. The vast majority of these encounters are not stationary, and the targets always shoot back. In fact, violent offenders usually make the first move, putting the victim at a significant disadvantage, both psychologically and emotionally. The good news is that there is at least a partial remedy to dealing with stress situations effectively. Let's assume you practice using your weapon regularly. When should you begin to feel like you can handle a tough situation? All right. When you can do this. There you go. Head.
Explain what it is.
Kidneys. And
ladies and gentlemen, we're
there you go.
Live streaming right now. Go to Facebook on heritagegunshop.com, and you get to see the target that Patty's showing.
Yeah, and this is also posted on the blog. Okay.
That's awesome. You can see the shot groups up in the head, chest, and the heart area, and then the kidneys. I think what they're trying to show there is the pelvic, the cradle. Because if you get shot in the hip, it's going to just drop you. It may not kill you, but it's going to drop you from being mobile.
And even if you're close to the kidneys and you hit a femoral, they're done. Okay. The photo that I've just showed you is a target from range training with one of my students. They were using the smallest Glock made, a Model 42, chambered in .380 caliber. Most of their magazines had a +2 extension, providing them with 9 rounds and with one in the chamber. Most notable is that these guns are very small and thus far more difficult to shoot accurately than a full-size weapon. Consider the size of your weapon. Okay. Now, that first photo revealed the results of 100 rounds of fire with movement under stress. The stress induced in this exercise was the requirement of movement before each shot. Each shot had to be taken within either 3 or 5 second intervals. Magazine changes were required without allowance for extra time between shots, and vocal commands to hit the various areas on the target were random. All right, the target areas were head, chest, center mass. Want to hold that up again?
Sure.
Hips requiring a specific rapid-fire sequence.
Check again, everybody, the live stream we're doing here.
And
right now.
4 3-inch precision targets outside of the body. The distance was within the range that most gun-related self-defense scenarios take place based on FBI statistics. Here's what you should notice. 100% of their kill zone shots were on target and would have resulted in disabling the attacker. 100% of their precision shots were on target. This means that they would likely be able to make difficult shots as with a hostage situation under stress. So this person was able to fire and hit what he wanted under stress.
Major, major importance.
Right. Okay. Now, here is the second photo. This photo reveals the same target after about 250 rounds. In the second exercise, I had the student focus on trigger reset for repeat fire requirements.
This guy knows what he's doing.
And magazine changes while moving. I also had them speed up their center mass shots and their shots to the hips. Here's what you should notice. Just short of 100% of their kill zone shots were on target and would have resulted in disabling the attacker. One center mass miss would have destroyed the attacker's collarbone. The other miss, lower right, would have passed through without any organ damage. just one short of 100% of their precision shots were on target.
Hey, Patty, let me interrupt you for a second. Hold your spot there on the article. This is so key. You shouldn't be saying this all the time. The reason we are so anal on being precision shooting in a self-defense mode, not a marksmanship mode. If you can be precision, and I'm, if you'll notice the video, I'm like kind of like doing a quarter side thing on her chest here. If I'm in that mode in self-defense, in training, the odds say I'll open up just a little bit in real life. But if I train and accept a wide group of shots, when it really does hit the fan, it's going to get bigger. So that's when you're talking about these precision shots, it's so vitally important that you do this in practice. Because if you don't do it in practice, and it's a wide shot group in practice, man, it's going to be way out of here when it comes to real life. So go ahead, I'm sorry.
And what he's saying is, if you can't hit the target standing still with no stress, how in the world are you going to take care of your business when you know what hits the fan?
False reality.
False reality. Just because you go and shoot at a paper target or you carry your gun around, you don't ever fire it, don't think that you are competent to do what you need to do.
I found this comment to be very effective, too. Sometimes when you go, well, you do that all the time. You do that all the time. So, of course, you're going to be good. Here's what I counter with that. Look, and you've heard me say this a million times, Patty. You're baking a cake, a baker screws it up. What do? They throw it in the garbage, they build another one, okay? You and I, the concealed carry person, a licensed carry person, when the stuff hits the fan, you better do it right the first time because there is no throwing it out and baking a cake, right?
Right.
That's why this aspect of what we're talking about is so important. As it would be the same thing as if you're sending the guy to the moon and you decide to use English configuration as compared to metric. Well, we're going to have a major problem, okay? You better know what you're freaking doing. Yep. There's only one crack at landing on the moon. Go ahead.
All right. Well, he was telling you that this they had one short of 100% of their precision shots were on target. That means they would likely be able to make difficult shots, as with a hostage situation under stress. Even one miss would have been in a kill zone of the hostage taker. Now, you might wonder how such training and practice was required for this level of accuracy. This student has been seriously engaged with cognitive combat shooting for a little more than a year. He's a very busy person. He has a sedentary job. He exercises daily, but he is average Joe. Bottom line, this level of shooting proficiency can be achieved by almost anyone in a relatively short period of time and is really the beginning of someone who is able to safely use a gun in a high-stress self-defense scenario. Okay, he has a lot more work to do, but you can see what training will do for you. Do not go out under the false sense of security when, you know, you really are not confident. What's worse than a bad guy with a gun? A good guy with a gun that doesn't know what he's doing. All right, be prepared. Stay vigilant. Remember that you are your first line of defense. Carrying a weapon is a great responsibility. Train, 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 and train some more. Come out and see us.
All right, Patty, let's talk about a couple of things real quick. We've got like 1.5 minutes here to talk about this before I go to the next segment. I had mentioned on a previous broadcast how awesome it was. I can't remember if it was in an opinion piece or something, but I was making a comment to how looking outside of what I do and watching other people who have no concept of who they are, what they do, but they train the same way. They've come with the same life experiences. And the thing what I'm trying to say is there are certain things that are not able to be argued with. Certain things happen, okay? And it's nice to know when somebody else who I don't even know does the same type of training based on experience, and the experience says, hey, this is what happened. It's not just like, okay, Matt, you're in a box, and this happened to you.
Yeah.
And, okay, you're going to judge. No, it's the same common thread with everybody. So you're reading this article, and he's coming up with these common threads, which is great. And we're talking about how shooting at a piece of paper is great. Yeah, the gun works, and it is able to hit a piece of target, a piece of paper at 7, 10, 15, 25 yards, okay? But under stress, here's what happened, okay? So that's cool to know that this guy thinks that way, too. The other thing you made comment to about was a smaller gun. Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot emphasize enough. If you have, let's use a 1911. 1911 is this big, and I'm being figurative, of course. If you're looking in the Ustream video on Facebook at Aaron's Gun Shop, it's this big, okay? The 1911 has so many different configurations when it comes to size, length of barrel, or, I'll tell you what, Jerry, come on in here to the frame. Let's see what you got, okay? I got one of my consultants coming here, Jerry. She's got a 1911, beautiful gun done by Sean McVicker, very well engraved, the whole works. A 1911's got a 5-inch barrel. That's your standard gun. But they've got guns that are 4-inch barrels, 3-inch, 3.5-inch barrels, 3-inch barrels, 8-rounds, 7-rounds, 6-rounds, okay? But this main compartment is the same thing. The smaller the gun gets, the harder it is to make sure it's up and running under a stressful situation. Let me do this back to you, Jerry. Beautiful gun. Sean McVicker, go to my website, radio page, look at the link, Stories and Steel. If you want a gun engraved, awesome, okay? But here's the deal. When you get a gun that's smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, the gun needs every bit of its energy to work, to function. If you're not doing it properly and you hold it wrong, you just stole 25%, 50% of the gun's energy, you're going to have a malfunction. So, yeah, it's cute, artsy-fartsy, all this kind of stuff to have a small gun. But if you don't know what you're doing and you screw it up, you're not going to be any good on the street. Unless you train and practice on how to clear malfunctions and all this kind of stuff, okay? So that's what's cool about that article that you were reading is how things are parallel. Even though we're not in the same circle, it's parallel of the same experiences.
It's so a common ground.
Common ground. Common ground. There you go. That's why she calls it Common Ground Newsletter. All right, Patty, you got like 15 seconds. Last things you want to say, people contact you, so on and so forth. Go ahead.
Go to our blog site. You can see the article. You can see the diagrams. I want to give a shout-out again to Radix Tactical. Go to their website. It's pretty nice. If you want to take a road trip, like I said, give me a call. I'm always ready for road trips. Come out and train with us.
She'll be back in heat, so any of you guys who think you're going to get something, don't forget about it, okay?
Let's go.
All right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's go to our product spotlight. I'm here live at AMC Firearms. We've got people coming in left and right here, and there's all sorts of guns, products, ammo, so on and so forth. But right now, I wanted to spotlight or highlight one of the guns that AMC Firearms have here. It's the Henry lever-action rifle. And here we go right here. If you're looking on our live stream and you hear that crash, no big deal. But over here a little bit more, partner. There you go. If you look at these guns right here, we're talking about Henry rifles. Brass receivers, brass barrel bands, the whole works. Very sexy guns. Let me talk to you about these. These are great rifles. And actually, I've got the .22 long rifle version, and I'm very impressed by the quality and fit of the rifles. And the wood stock is beautiful. It's made of walnut, and I think it's American walnut, to be honest with you, and solid as a rock. The blending of metal to wood, it's almost like there's no separation. I had a Winchester, model 11, I forget what the model number was, but it was like a beautiful blending of metal and wood. It's the same thing with these Henrys. They've got this down pat. The lever action is smooth and crisp, and when you pick one up, you just want to go, yeehaw, or round up some cattle, or be on some type of sheriff's posse, okay? So I'm going to read to you what I picked up from the Henry website, and this is from henryrifles.com. It says, back when the West was still wild and the rifle was the tool of choice for survival and frontier justice, the .44 caliber, and they're talking about all calibers here, but I've got one specifically, a .357 caliber. But it says here, the .44 caliber put more meat on the table and outlaws in the ground than any other bullet. The West may have tamed and fenced long ago, but its unbridled spirit lives on in this line of traditional big bore Henry rifle. You can choose from .44 Magnum, .45 Long Colt, and .357 Magnum, which AMC Firearms, Arch Coons, the owner, has all these guns right here. Now, this is really big. When I first saw this on the website, I know this is big for a lot of people. It's SASS, Single Action Shooting Society approved. Certain requirements you have to have for a certain gun if you're going to participate in those kind of competitions. All are SASS approved, so cowboy action shooters who enjoy stepping back that bygone era can use them in competition. Don't let the retro look fool you. These rifles are much more than shooting irons for today's new breed of shooter cowboy. They're also an unbeatable choice of big game hunters who prefer traditional look, feel, reliability, and accuracy that comes from the authentic Henry rifle. Now, each big boy, they call them the big boy rifles, the ones that are in these particular calibers, Receivers come drilled and tapped for easy scope mounting, and the barrels are fitted with fully adjustable sights. The traditional 20-inch octagonal barrel is outfitted with a classic, fully adjustable semi-buckhorn rear sight with a reversible white diamond insert and a brass beaded front sight. The tubular magazine tops off at 10 rounds. Both the straight grip stock, that's a hard one to say. And if you're not sure what that means, it just means where you put your hand on the rifle, your dominant hand, it's just a straight stock. Some of them have a curve, almost like a pistol grip. But this one's a particular straight grip stock, and forearm are crafted of select American walnut, accented with a brass barrel band and the Henry's recognizable brass receiver. Let me make a comment on this. Some guns have plastic barrel bands. This one here, I'm impressed. It's an authentic brass band that goes around the barrel, so that's pretty cool. All have a crisp, smooth action that sets the authentic American-made Henry apart from other lever-action rifles on the range and in the woods today. Also, the .44 Magnum can also shoot .44 special rounds. Now, that's not as... I don't see too many people shooting .44 specials, but what's nice about it, .44 Magnum is the cartridge of my choice with my lever actions. I like it, just more power, and you can shoot a .44 special in it. You don't see too many .44 specials, but they're still out there for sure. But they've got the .357 Magnum that can also shoot the .38 special rounds, and that's prominent and common. A lot of people shooting .357 Magnum revolvers. If you got this rifle, you can have a pistol on your side, .357, and also shoot your Henry lever action rifle and .357. I'll tell you what, Carter, give me that one rifle right there, front, right, that's it right there. And I want to show people on the video here. If you look at this rifle, it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. They've got the sleeve on here to protect the brass receiver. Actually, I think I'm going the wrong way with this thing. Let's see here. I want to show it to you. You can see the brass receiver, absolutely beautiful. Beautiful gun, walnut, look at the grain on this thing, brass barrel band, got the brass butt plate, the large loop. This is an awesome gun, and it's tapped for putting a scope on it. Come on out to ANC Firearms in Heidenhammer. They've got a nice selection, great price. This thing is freaking stout. I like it a lot. I really do. You know, I'm a tactical shooter. You all know me by now. I'm a tactical shooter. But when you want to go down to the basics, this works every time you try it. So there you go. Okay, so it's the Henry rifle. Come check it out here at ANC Firearms, and I think you'll like it a lot. Okay, here's what we're going to do, guys. We're going to take about another minute and a half break, and what we're going to do when we come back on the other side, we're going to give you a special interview with Officer Paul Benton. I went on a ride-along with Officer Paul Benton. I'm not going to say what department he's with or where we were located, but it's going to be a nice interview. It's going to talk about a lot of things that I find interesting. I think you will find interesting, too. Paul and I are very good friends. I'm able to talk to him freely. He gives me straight answers. He knows where I'm coming from. He's a good guy. Everybody out there, law enforcement, this guy is a good guy. He's a straight shooter, okay? So we're going to talk to you. And what we're going to do here, we're going to cut off on the live stream, because we're playing the recorded interview, and I might be able to come back at the very end at about 1:25 or so. It depends on how much time we got left, and I'll talk to you again. But we're going to give to you for about the next 25 minutes or so an interview with me and Paul with a ride-along, doing patrol one night, get an inside look as to what's going on. Okay, so we'll talk to you on the other side, and enjoy the interview. Everyone, hi, this is Matt with Aaron's Gun Shop with the Aaron's High-Calf Adventure Radio Program. I am very blessed tonight. Today, this morning, whatever you want to call it, it's dark outside. Today is April 5th, so about another 5 minutes, and then it'll be April 6th. So I'm here talking with Officer Paul Benton. We are in an undisclosed location, and I have the honor and the privilege to be with him. He's let me ride along with him to check out what it's like to be an officer and what the duties that entail in being an officer. And I think we're going to have a good time. We're going to ask him some questions here, and he's going to give me some good straight answers. So for your enjoyment and for your knowledge and for your listening pleasure, we're going to continue. Paul, how you doing?
Good.
I appreciate you letting me come out here to ride along with you and check things out. And first of all, how long have you been an officer?
15 years.
Same departments?
No, I've been through a couple different agencies.
And what is it about being an officer that you like?
Oh, the structure of what we do. Prior military, so it you know kind of hand in hand with that. I do enjoy helping people. I enjoy getting out and meeting new people, and it's never the same thing every day.
Not boring. That's right. Yeah, it's funny that you say that. Certain part of what you just said, Jeff. I've been dealing with guns all my life. And if I don't have a gun near me, on me, or around me, I feel naked. It's kind of the same thing, I'm assuming, if you're military, because I know I wanted to become an officer before. But when you're in the military, you're doing that type of work, especially if you're a combat soldier of some sort, or a Marine, or whatever, this is kind of a second nature. It's like if you're not doing this type of work, it's almost like you're stuck doing this type of work.
Yeah.
What is the hardest thing about your job?
Dealing with the political aspect of it, you know, laws change quite regularly, and just relearning to change laws, dealing with what we call frequent flyers, the same people for the same thing all the time, that's probably the biggest part that I don't like about it.
Yeah, that brings up a question, the repeat individuals. Here you've got an individual who maybe doesn't do anything wrong. He's always trying to do their best, be a law-abiding citizen. And yet they screw up one time and it seems like they go through the ringer. But then when you get the repeat offenders, they keep coming back out doing the same thing. It just doesn't seem right. Well, what is the deal behind that? Any idea?
That's both me. I do know what you mean. If I caught Joe Schmuck out here drinking and driving, and I caught Model A citizen out here drinking and driving, I'm going to charge them with the same thing. And everything will be the same from my point. It's when they get up into the prosecution part of it that it changes, I would assume.
And there's some laws that you don't like, but because you are wearing the badge and you swore an oath, you're going to do them anyway. But are there some things that just you know kind of grind on you? It's like, oh, I don't really want to do this, but I have to.
Yeah, there are. There's certain laws. It's like, why on earth are those even laws? So
when the person gets stopped because of that law, it's not so much you. It's like if you got a problem, you've got to go and go through the political system to get the law changed. You're just a guy on the beat doing his duty, swearing an oath, and wearing the badge of honor, right?
I try.
Great. Can you tell us a story? What's maybe some of the things that you're looking for when you're on the road? Anything in particular that you're looking for?
Like right now, I'm watching for speeders, looking for equipment violations, lights out, that sort of thing.
Do you use that type of problem as a doorway to see if there's something major, or is it just, I'll just say, is that because we're looking to not be bored one night, or to get revenue, or is it just a gateway to get you in to see, hey, I might be able to find something really serious?
Probably a combination of all. If you get tired, you pull somebody over for a busted taillight, you know, helps you wake up. And it does give you that opportunity to speak with them and see if there's something else going on within that vehicle. I don't make it a habit to write citations for equipment violations. I don't get out and check the back of my truck every time I get into it and turn it on. It's just a more of a courtesy stop, as well as seeing if there's anything more. Right.
Are you 10-6?
Running traffic.
All right, everybody. We're back again. It's later on in the morning now. We've been sitting out here, done a couple of traffic stops. We had to shut the recording device off earlier due to the fact we had traffic going over the radio. We wanted to cut it off. So we waited a while. We're back here now. And Paul, we've done. I'm back here with Officer Paul Benton in an undisclosed location in the state of Texas. And he's doing his duty and keeping us safe the best he can. But Paul, we've done a couple of traffic stops. We checked a group of people out. And I'm very security conscious myself, very aware of my surroundings. And as I'm watching you, we're coming up to a scenario and these situations. I see potential dangers all over the place, you know, especially at nighttime, multiple people in the vehicle, you're on a dark side of the road, not much traffic, something can go down. If you're by yourself, what do you do? What's going through your mind when you do these traffic stops?
Well, welcome to my world. Yeah, walking up to a car, you never know what is inside that car. It's dark out. You can't see inside the vehicle very well. You're making your approach. You're checking the back seat. You're checking the front seat. Is the driver acting stupid? Has he got passengers? Are they being...
Well, I think a lot more people are getting licensed to carry, CHLs licensed to carry, more and more people are realizing that. And here's another thing. Here's what I'm thinking. I could be totally wrong. Won't be the first time. But there has been a wild division between law enforcement and the civilian populace for a block of time. I'd have to say it grew within the last 10 years. And it's wearing people out. And you've got bad people in each section. You got bad cops sometimes. You got bad civilians sometimes. And the media just blows it up, makes it bad. And then everybody starts getting this paranoia. And so they started getting like, well, why are these people hassling? Why is an officer hassling me? Well, you got to think about it. You got to say, this cop on the beat, on the middle of a highway, out in the middle of nowhere, at 3 o'clock in the morning, is by himself, and he's got to have some type of protocol to protect himself. And the person behind the wheel should have the common sense to realize, you know, if that was me wearing the badge and I was coming up to this car, I'd want the same courtesy. I think it's all about courtesy, and hopefully people are realizing that courtesy needs to come back so that we can all start being and working together. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I'll tell you this. In the last 6 months, I've had more people tell me they appreciate me and what I do than I did in the prior 14 years of my law enforcement career. Since all this cop killing, all these riots, and we've had police officers that were ambushed, and it makes me feel good because I get out on a traffic stop, and when the traffic stop is done, I'm having people say, sir, we appreciate what you do. Please be safe tonight. And that's even if I write them a ticket. And, you know, it feels good to be appreciated.
Absolutely. I would agree with you. You know, I was just thinking while you were talking, I was listening to you, but I was also thinking about what I just said, why I say what I say. You know, because I do what I do with this radio show, and just because I am an informed individual and I'm always doing my homework and I'm researching, I see things from all across the planet, all across the country, all across the state, and all locally, and it's like it's an information overload to me. So I get to see what's going on, whereas somebody else may disagree because they're in their own little world and may not do the research that I do, and they don't get to see that. But there is definitely a separation or a barrier, and we just need to turn that around. We definitely need to eliminate that because you guys do a very good job. You're putting your lives on the line every day to do your best to secure us. And I tell a lot of officers, hey, you know my number, and if I'm available, give me a call. I'll back you up. So it's good to have you on the street. We appreciate that. And which brings up another question. What are your thoughts about ride-alongs? And I'm not just talking ride-alongs just for giggles. I'm talking ride-alongs for people out there who are very informed and are very concerned and are wanting to help. They may not wear a badge, but they can at least be your second set of eyes here. Can get like a volunteer force that can come and alternate day to day to be a ride along. Is that a good thing?
They probably could. I think there's several agencies that do what they call a Citizens Police Academy. I believe that entitles people that go through that academy to ride with the officers. I'm not sure. We have a reserve force where people actually give their time and come in and do this for free.
They're actually officers.
Yes,
right?
Yes, they do it. Yes, they are reserve police officers. I tell people all the time, you know, they ask, what's it like to do your job? Well, come right out with me and find out. And
can that be a detriment to you at any time?
No, not really. I don't do anything that would get myself in trouble.
No, I'm not talking. I'm talking about the ride-along. Could it be a hindrance? Could it be another thing to worry about?
Well, it puts a second person. It makes me responsible for a second person.
That's what I was getting at.
You know, I've got to worry not only for my safety, but now there's an unarmed individual in my patrol unit, and you know, if somebody starts shooting at me, now I've got to be concerned about getting that other person out of the way and out of harm's way.
So then let's go back to my initial question. Would you probably think more that it's not maybe a good idea to have unlicensed people who are riding along with you, a reserve person, as compared to just a regular Joe on the street because of that reason? That makes sense?
Yes, it could be a problem. Like I said, I've been an officer for 15 years. I've never had to fire my weapon. I've seen where somebody with a rider has gotten to that point. I'm not saying it won't happen, by no means. As many as So I enjoy having a second person in the vehicle sometimes, especially somebody that is not in law enforcement. It kind of opens their eyes a little bit. I really enjoy when the younger crowd comes and rides out with me. I'm not saying you're old or anything, Matt.
Yeah, well, you said it plenty other times, but you're not straight.
But, you know, there was a while where there was a boy who just graduated high school, and he was thinking about becoming an officer, and he rode out with me several times. And he's now a dispatcher. And his intent, when he turns 21, he's become a police officer. There was a young man that rode out with me years ago who became a police officer. So it's kind of like, you know, am I doing something that would impress somebody to the point they want to do what I do? And a couple of times it would appear that it has worked.
Well, that's great, because I've always commented and complimented you on how common sense you are in your decisions. I mean, you're here doing your duty under oath, but you've got common sense. And I try to teach that in my class all the time. You know, there's got to be common sense from us, and there's got to be common sense from the officer as well. And together, we're going to get along no problems.
Right.
And you'll see a situation, and it's like what you said about the traffic, the taillight. You don't always check the back of your taillight or your car for your broken taillights. So when you come up to a vehicle that has a broken taillight, you might find, just may not have seen it or something. So we'll warn them, we'll play it by ear, see what happens. But I'm not going to go up and say, I'm going to bust you and write you a ticket. So you got common sense. I've known you for a while. I've seen it repetitively, that you have good common sense and good judgment. And hopefully you can relay that to some new people who join the force, and you should be proud that you can convey that to somebody else. Now, Paul, is there any little inside things that people on the outside don't know that would be kind of interesting or fun to know, and you're willing to share it with the people?
Like what?
Well, how about this? How about coding? When you're coded on the street, if you're on the side of the road, is there something we could look for or see if you need help besides screaming and waving your hands?
Well, that's usually a real good indicator. We do things amongst ourselves. I'm not going to exactly tell you what it is, because a lot of the times we don't want everybody to know.
Well, yeah, definitely don't do that, though. Sure.
But we do have some ways of acknowledging, and we usually do it when we know there's another patrol unit coming towards us, or we've actually seen it, and we'll give the sign of what code we're in. You know, if we get one sign, then they'll either pass on by or stop out, like they're just checking to see what's going on. If we give another one, then they're probably going to slam on their brakes and bail out of the vehicle and come running.
Well, so anyway, let's get off the officer there. Let's talk more about a person driving by, and he thinks that you're in distress.
Uh-huh.
I'm assuming you would like the backup from anybody at that point. But if somebody's coming up and you don't know who they are, what would be a good thing for them to do to put you at ease to know that they're on your side?
Just start hauling out. Officer, do you need help? Officer, I'm here. What do you need? What do you need?
What if they're a licensed to carry person? Do they come out with their handgun? Do they start screaming, hey, I'm an LTC, I'm an LTC? That'd probably freak you out seeing another gun coming down the street, right?
Yeah, if I looked up and there's somebody else coming at me with a gun and I'm in the middle of a firefight, I'm probably going to start shooting at them as well. I would holler out something. A lot, you know, I've thought that scenario over. What if about a shot, and I was down, and, you know, not unconscious, but down, and all of a sudden, somebody pulls over, and they come out with another gun. You know, it's kind of like, well, crap. But, you know, if they come out, and they're yelling at whoever shot me, saying, get away from the officer, get away from the officer, you know, something to that effect, it's going to give me a second of hesitation to figure out what's going on. And there's just so many what ifs.
Bottom line is, there's body language, there's verbal, there's situational awareness. Combining all those things through experience, you can basically tell when somebody's on your side, whether or not. As long as they don't come charging out with a gun saying, hey, I can help you. You know,
right.
Enough
to prove. Let the officer know you're there to help them. Matt, some of the training we've done together, the stress takes over, the five fingers come to, you get tunnel vision. If somebody comes out of their vehicle, you're going to need to really, really make a point to let that officer know you're there for him. Not just, hey, cop, I'm here for you, and then run at it. So repeat it.
AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America.